I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My guest today, Dr. Linda L. Isaacs, received her Bachelor's of Science degree from the University of Kentucky, graduating with high distinction with a major in biochemistry. She was elected to Phi Beta Kappa. She subsequently received her medical degree from Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in 1985. She completed a residency in internal medicine at the Department of Veterans Affairs Medical Center at New York University Medical School. She is certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine, most recently recertified in 2011. Dr. Isaacs worked with her colleague Nicholas J. Gonzalez, MD, for more than 20 years, using a nutritional approach for treating patients diagnosed with cancer and other serious degenerative illnesses. After his untimely death in July 2015, she has continued with the work they shared. The treatment involves diet, which varies from patient to patient, and can range from almost exclusively vegetarian to one that is heavy in animal protein and fat. Individualized treatment supplement protocols, which includes large doses of pancreatic enzymes and procedures such as coffee enemas that help the body rid itself of metabolic waste. In 1999, Dr. Isaacs and Dr. Gonzalez completed a research study in patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. The results were published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition and Cancer, showing survival well beyond what is described in the medical literature. They also published a series of cancer reports in the peer-reviewed journal Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine, and co-authored the book, The Trophoblast and the Origin of Cancer. Dr. Isaac wrote the article, Deciding to Pursue an Alternative Cancer Therapy, to help prospective patients sort through their options. And it is available on her website at www.drlindai.com/pursuing_alt_THER.html. Visit her website at drlindai.com to learn more about her treatment and review the application process to become a patient. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Isaacs, and I'm very interested in hearing about your approach to cancer treatment. Now, first, you are a conventionally trained, board-certified internal medicine physician. So how did you get interested in alternative approaches to cancer?
Well, first of all, let me just say it's a pleasure to be on your show with you. You certainly have a very interesting background yourself, so it's good to have the opportunity to get to know you and to be here for your studio audience as well. How did I get interested in this? Well, in some ways, I think I might have been a little more open-minded than some of my classmates in medical school, partly because my mother was very interested in nutrition. And also, when I was an undergraduate, I worked in a biochemistry lab for a couple of years, actually, and they were trying to study something to prove a particular hypothesis, and it's not really important what it was. What was more important for me was that as a first-year medical student, I was sitting there listening to a lecture, and they presented the hypothesis we'd been trying to prove as an actual proven fact, and I knew that it wasn't, and so it made me wonder how many things in the medical world am I being being taught that aren't necessarily correct.
Mm-hmm.
So I think both of those things might have made me a little more open-minded. Then when I was a third-year medical student, during that year, a person does various clinical rotations, and I was assigned to an internal medicine team with a doctor named Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. He was the intern on the team, but he was already engaged in a study of the work of Dr. William Donald Kelly, who was an orthodontist who had devised a method of treating cancer. And Nick had gotten interested in Kelly's work. He had met him a couple of years earlier when he himself was a medical student and had started investigating Kelly's work. And what he found in Kelly's record were a large number of people with appropriately diagnosed cancer who had outlived their expected lifespan by many, many years, many people that were doing just fine who would have been expected to die long since in the ordinary course of things. And Nick was willing to talk about his research really to anybody who would listen, and I was certainly willing to listen. He and I worked together for a six-week period there, but that, in effect, was the springboard for me getting involved in this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Great. Good. Dr. Isaac, could you tell us about your nutritional approach to cancer?
Sure. The treatment involves three things. First of all is a diet, and the diets will actually vary from person to person. They tend to fall into one of two extremes for most people that are diagnosed with cancer. One end of the spectrum would be a more vegetarian diet, although we do typically allow people to eat some eggs, some fish, some dairy, depending on what their system tolerates. But it's a more vegetarian diet, and that's a diet that we would typically recommend for people with carcinomas. That would be your typical cancers like lung cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer. The people on the other end of the spectrum are people that are told to eat a lot of red meat. It's almost the mirror opposite of the first diet, and that's just something we typically recommend for people with cancers of the immune system like leukemias, lymphomas, many times patients with melanoma, and there's some theoretical underpinnings behind that I can get into in a minute. We also recommend supplements, a lot of nutritional supplements, some of which are designed to help strengthen the body, and those would be heavy on calcium for the people that are supposed to eat a lot of red meat, heavy with magnesium and potassium for those that should eat a more vegetarian diet. But then there's also large amounts of pancreatic enzymes. We feel that pancreatic enzymes are a big part, if not the only part, of the body's surveillance mechanism for cancer. And so when a patient has developed cancer, that means that they're not making enough enzymes, and so we supply those in very large amounts. The third part of the protocol is detoxification, and that involves various things that help the body get rid of the waste materials that can form as the enzymes encourage repair and rebuilding to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in a nutshell, is the protocol: diet, supplements, detoxification.
Mm-hmm. My diet was a vegan diet, which, mm-hmm. again, was very progressive for 1974. And it wasn't too bad. I'm on it again for AFib, following sort of Dr. Isaac Stein's book and mm-hmm. Dr. Sinatra's book, but it's not too bad.
Well, most of the time, people actually feel pretty well on the diets that we tell them to eat.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if a patient that should be eating a lot of animal protein puts themselves on a vegan diet, they'll feel terrible. So
oh.
They wouldn't be saying,
mm-hmm.
oh gosh, you know, it actually works pretty well for me. They would feel awful. Whereas, you know, typically a patient that should be on a more vegetarian diet
mm-hmm.
will not feel well at all if they proceed to go off and try something like an Atkins-type diet
mm-hmm.
with a lot of animal protein. So for the most part, people are attracted to what's good for them. The one big exception, of course, is white sugar, which everybody loves and nobody should eat, or most people love, I guess I should say. I've had a few people that didn't like it, but most of us will eat sweets if they're put in front of us, and they're not good for anybody.
Right, and I don't eat sweets at all.
Oh, good.
But I think that part of my not having a recurrence was also that I stayed on mostly the diet, and I continued the prayer and the meditation and the things I was doing before. So it wasn't like having treatment and then once I was better, going in a whole different lifestyle. And I think that's probably important for people.
Definitely. Yeah, as a physician, it's really very frustrating sometimes that, you know, patients will decide that if they're doing some better, it's time to quit and go back to the lifestyle that got them sick in the first place. So, yeah, that can be, I mean, I guess it's understandable in many ways, but at the same time, it's kind of like shooting yourself in the foot. It doesn't make logical sense.
Right. Then conventional scientists consider pancreatic enzymes as only digestive enzymes. Who first proposed that they have an anti-cancer effect?
Well, Dr. Kelly, you know, our predecessor in this work, the orthodontist, had actually been diagnosed with what was probably pancreatic cancer in the early 60s, and he kind of serendipitously discovered that that pancreatic enzymes could make a difference in the tumor that he could actually feel in his abdomen. He started taking large amounts of them, hoping to aid his digestion, but what he found was that it also altered the character of the tumor that he had in his abdomen. Now, Kelly had a lot of scientific curiosity, and when he discovered that, he went off to a medical library to see if anybody else had ever thought that pancreatic enzymes might have a role in treating cancer. And what he found was the work of a man named Dr. John Beard. Dr. Beard was an embryologist by training. He worked at the University of Edinburgh. Embryology is the study of the very early stages of life. So for mammals, like people or mammals, it would be the stage of the very small being that forms right after conception, right up until the time of delivery. That study of that phase of our life is embryology. And what Beard noticed was that there was a tissue in the embryo called the trophoblast, and its job is to latch on to the mother's uterus to form a connection so that the developing baby can get its source of nutrients and have a place to get rid of waste. And so the trophoblast latches onto the uterus and it invades. It works its way in, it creates its own blood supply, and it tricks the mother's immune system into thinking that there's nothing to react to here, so that even though the baby is very genetically very different from the mother's immune system doesn't see the baby and the trophoblast part of the baby in effect as an invader. So the way the trophoblast acts, Beard realized, was very similar to what a cancer does, because cancer can invade and create its own blood supply. And even though there's typically a lot of genetic abnormalities in a cancer cell, it doesn't form, you know, the body's immune system doesn't react to it. So Beard recognized that the early stage of the trophoblast is very similar to a cancer in its appearance, but there's one big difference, and that's that the trophoblast at a certain point stops. It matures, turns into the placenta, which forms that connection between the baby and the mother for the rest of the pregnancy, and then when the baby is born, the placenta neatly peels off and leaves the mother's body intact so more children can be born in the future. The cancer just keeps going, and so Beard theorized that whatever that signal was that told the trophoblast to mature and change into the placenta might also be an answer to cancer. So he looked at a lot of different things that are going on in the both the mother's body and the baby's body at the time that that change occurs. And what he found was that that change occurred around the time that the baby started making pancreatic enzymes. Now, if pancreatic enzymes were only useful for digestion, there's really no reason for the baby to be making them at around, you know, 2 months of fetal development. The baby's not going to see a meal for another 7 months. But if enzymes are valuable in terms of controlling the behavior of the trophoblast, well, it makes all kinds of sense then that they would be made very early in development. So this was Beard's theory. He wasn't in a position to put it to work, so to speak, because he was a scientist. He wasn't a physician. Mm-hmm. But various physicians did try it out back when Beard was working in the early 1900s. And some of them had very good results. The trouble was that it wasn't easy to get a stable source of pancreatic enzymes in that era. Mm-hmm. And people would want to use products that had been dried in some way and then reconstituted. Well, enzymes are not necessarily stable in that setting. So not everybody got good results. And there was a lot of argument back and forth about why not. But at Beard's time and over the years since then, and there have been patients and practitioners that have gotten good results with cancer with pancreatic enzymes.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned to you earlier that I use pancreatic enzymes for lung cancer, and I used something called Wobimogus made in mm-hmm. Germany, which mm-hmm. is no longer available. Could you tell the listeners what might be a good substitute for that?
Well, the pancreatic enzymes that I recommend to my patients are actually only available from a very specific source that only sells to my patients. But the closest thing that's commercially available is from a company called Allergy Research Group. And they have a branch called Nutricology that sells to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And the product is called Pancreas. It's a very simple name.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the closest thing that's available on the open market.
Mm-hmm. Great. I appreciate that. And I think you talked a little bit earlier about having two nutritional approaches depending upon the patient. And, for example, the lung cancer would be more appropriate, the vegan-type diet. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the patients eat?
Well, okay, so like I said, you know, I don't recommend the exact same thing
mm-hmm.
To everybody, mm-hmm. but it does fall into two general patterns, which is that people with your typical cancers like lung cancer, colon cancer, the ones that are called carcinomas, they would typically be on something that's more vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
So a patient like that would typically be eating, quite a bit of their diet, ideally would be raw, just because raw food gives a lot more of the enzymes and the nutrients that are valuable. There are some things we do recommend cooking, but for the most part, a lot of the food would be uncooked. They're allowed to eat things like a wide variety of vegetables. I think carrot juice is very valuable, and vegetable juice in general is extremely valuable. Fruits are fine for that type of patient, as long
mm-hmm.
as they're not extremely overweight. You know, that throws an extra variable into it, but fruit is a perfectly acceptable food. As far as grains go, you know, I think that there are some people that have a genuine issue with gluten-containing products, with
mm-hmm.
wheat-containing products, but I think that right at the moment in the alternative world, there's been an overreaction, and I think a lot of people will do perfectly well with grain products, including wheat. For many people, the issue really isn't about wheat, it's about non-organic wheat, which
mm-hmm.
may be
mm-hmm.
pretty heavily sprayed with chemicals that can affect the gut bacteria. So I think that's why a lot of people are getting digestive issues with wheat these days. But, you know, that one, I just allow people to decide what they want to do based on what kinds of symptoms, if any, they get when they eat wheat. Then nuts and seeds are also very valuable. Beans are great. And I think eggs and dairy and fish can be very valuable for the patients in that category
mm-hmm.
as well. The main issue is to not eat foods that are extremely acid-forming,
mm-hmm.
Because that pushes the body chemistry in the wrong direction. Patients with the carcinomas tend to be too acid on a cellular level, and that so you want to give them foods that aren't going to make them even more acid.
Mm-hmm.
So steak is out for those folks.
Mm-hmm.
It's a more vegetarian type of diet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'd also like to add, mm-hmm. though, that we do definitely stress the use of organic foods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that can be a little more limiting for diet, just because, you know, the American culture seems to have become that people want to be able to eat out a lot and eat on the run and, you know, have dinner ready 5 minutes after they walked into the house because they just popped a box of something or other into the microwave. And I don't think that's a good way to eat, and it's not going to work on this protocol.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely with the organic. Fortunately, in 1974, there was not a problem with food supply. So, you know, there wasn't such a thing as organic, non-organic. But I agree that most have to have organic now. The other thing I wonder about the wheat is if it isn't related to the genetically modified organism. And the reason that I wonder that is because when I'm in Germany, I can eat things that I can't eat in this country because of my gluten sensitivity. And so there's something different about the food in Germany than there is in the United States.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if maybe that isn't the genetically modified foods.
Well, I can't really claim to be an expert on this topic, mm-hmm. but I'll give you what I understand anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You know, I believe that the genetically modified foods are typically modified in order to make it possible either to use very heavy amounts of the herbicide and have the plant that's been modified be resistant to the herbicide so that it's only the weeds that are killed, or to create some kind of immunity to some sort of insect pest.
Mm-hmm.
So what that can wind up meaning is, you know, in the case of the foods that were modified to fight off insect pests, well, the entity that was introduced into the food could well be having an effect on the gut bacteria. The same thing applies with the heavy doses of herbicides. You know, the manufacturers mm-hmm. claim that they're perfectly safe for humans, but that doesn't mean that they're perfectly safe for our gut bacteria. And almost every day, there's a new article about how important the gut bacteria are to health. None of that was known at the time that these various genetically modified organisms were brought into the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of information that's come along since those things were introduced that would explain potentially why people are having trouble tolerating them. But I've heard what you said about, you know, people saying they can tolerate wheat products in Europe, but they mm-hmm. can't tolerate them here. Well, that's because there's different regulations in terms of what can be grown and used in
mm-hmm.
Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That may well have an effect on our gut.
Mm-hmm. Also, you mentioned the raw fruit and vegetables, and my regime specified 75% raw, and then you could have some cooked beyond that. So
mm-hmm.
the diet was pretty close, except you do allow some dairy and fish, which was not allowed on mine for the first 3 months, I believe.
Right. Well, what I'd say there, the protocol that we use a lot of pancreatic enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
And pancreatic
mm-hmm.
enzymes can digest protein.
Mm-hmm.
So by using quite a large amount of them, it helps to liberalize the diet a little bit
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
some of the enzymes that we have people take will go to work on what they ate.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it possible to give a little more protein.
Mm-hmm.
I personally believe that some of the very restrictive diets, as far as protein goes, have their benefit by liberating some of the body's own enzymes to go to work on cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is that many patients, we believe, just can't manage that degree of protein restriction. So by giving extra enzymes, it just helps
mm-hmm.
us be able to let them have a bit more protein.
That makes a lot of sense, and that's exactly why the rationale for the raw had to do with the pancreatic enzymes and
mm-hmm.
having them free to work with the supplements and all. And
mm-hmm.
so I think that probably if the doctor had increased mine, then it would have allowed me to have some of these things that a lot of people won't, you know, follow if they don't have them. I did,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of people won't, as you say. So makes a lot of sense. And what about the coffee enemas then? Where did that idea come from?
Well, Dr. Kelly, our predecessor in this work, had come down with what was most likely pancreatic cancer in the early 60s. I say most likely because there weren't any CAT scans or needle biopsies. So when he presented to his physicians with a mass in his abdomen and massive weight loss, the only way that they could have definitively said what was wrong with him was to do an operation. But they felt he was clearly terminal, so they didn't want to cut him open just to make an academic point. And so he was told to get his affairs in order, and instead what he did was, first of all, he modified his diet and stabilized. Then he started taking a lot of pancreatic enzymes and felt the tumor change its character. But then what happened was he started to get sick. He started to get a lot of flu-like symptoms and nausea to the point where he couldn't get his enzymes down anymore. So when he stopped taking them, those symptoms resolved. But then almost as soon as he started taking them again, he got sick again. And so he realized that it seemed like the enzymes were attacking the cancer, but he wasn't he wasn't feeling well during that process, and he needed to figure out a way to help get rid of tumor waste. He speculated that that's what was going on. Now, he said that he found the idea for coffee enemas in something called the Merck Manual. Mm-hmm. The Merck Manual bills itself as the oldest continuously published medical textbook in the U.S. It's still available, although in a digital form, and coffee enemas were in there right up until the 1960s or maybe 70s. But it turns out, though, so Dr. Kelly started using coffee enemas, and he felt better, and then he was able to stay on his enzymes, and eventually got better. But that turned his orthodontics practice into an alternative cancer practice because people heard about how he had turned his own situation around, and people started to come to him, not for tooth straightening, but for getting their cancer straightened out. But having said all of that, coffee enemas have actually been around for a long time. Another practitioner that used them a lot was Dr. Max Gerson. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I did a little investigating in the medical literature, and I found references to coffee enemas in various journals that I found from the 1800s. I believe the oldest one I tracked down was 1860. I'm sure they were used before that. And I even found a reference to a lecture that one of the Mayo brothers that started the Mayo Clinic gave in 1896, where he talked about coffee enemas being critically important for post-operative care. Things like enemas kind of went out of favor in the 1950s as various pharmacological treatments started to become available. But I actually found an article very recently, interestingly enough, where some investigators in Korea tried coffee enemas as a way to clear bile out before patients would do something called capsule endoscopy, which is where you basically swallow a little camera and it travels through the intestinal tract. It's used for trying to find things where scopes can't go, so to speak. But a big problem with those procedures is bile being released that will obscure what they can see with the camera. So these investigators tried having some patients do coffee enemas before they swallowed their little camera, and other patients didn't do coffee enemas. And what they found was that there was less bile obscuring the camera when they used coffee enemas, which supports the idea that coffee enemas stimulate bile flow. And bile is where the liver gets rid of waste materials. So interestingly enough, very recently somebody did a study that would kind of suggest that coffee enemas do have a physiologic effect that might explain why they make people feel better. From my point of view, though, they make people feel better, and that's why we do them, or have patients do them. That's why I do them myself, for that matter.
So they are useful for people that want to detox that are not necessarily on your protocol. Is that correct?
There are certainly lots of people doing coffee enemas out there that are not on my protocol. I guess I always have to be a little cautious about saying anything specific, just because I don't want somebody to blame me if it without medical supervision. But having said that, you know, as long as somebody has an intestinal tract that works pretty normally, they should be fine with coffee enemas.
Great. Good. Then, Dr. Isaacs, your program is primarily nutritional in orientation. How do you think patients' psychological and spiritual orientation fit into their treatment plan?
Well, I think it has a huge effect. And, you know, I think that part of that may be mediated through the autonomic nervous system, which is the body's system that takes care of the reactions that we don't consciously control. The sympathetic nervous system is a fight or flight system. And typically with people with carcinomas, that system is overactive. Emotions can play a role in triggering the sympathetic nervous system. You know, as an example, I give patients a lot. If you get angry about something or stressed about something, you might find that your heart starts to beat faster and it jumps up in your throat and you break out in a sweat and you feel, you know, you feel tense all over. Well, that's the exact same type of symptom that you might get if a tiger was walking down the street towards you. That's the sympathetic system turning on. But that system is not conducive to healing. It's more a system that's designed to help us deal with immediate stresses. So if somebody is in an emotional state that's constantly triggering that stress response system, it's going to be very difficult for their body to heal. So that's where, you know, emotional and spiritual aspects can definitely play a role. And, you know, there again, you know, back in the 70s, if you said that to a doctor, they would probably laugh at you. Mm-hmm. But here lately, you know, there's been more interest in this type of thing. And as an example, you know, I recently read an article that was talking about how patients who were stressed, you know, or emotionally upset about something, that they would check their EKG. The ECG looking at their heart, and they would find actual changes in the rhythm of the heart when people were stressed versus when they were thinking more peaceful thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a physiologic effect that comes with emotional and spiritual upset.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's extremely important.
Related to what you said, I recently read that optimism will lower the CA125 protein, which again shows a physiological effect. Another one is forgiveness.
Right.
People who do not forgive, and about 61% of all cancer patients have that as a problem, but those who do not forgive develop chronic anxiety, which leads to a depletion of killer cells. Mm. So I find that all of these things that are coming out now very interesting about this connection that people like Bernie Siegel have talked about for a long time, but, you know, it wasn't part of practice with most people. So I think it's an exciting time to be involved in cancer treatment with all of that's going on.
Yeah, and I think that kind of input, especially from somebody like yourself with your, you know, your track record as a longtime survivor of a typically very deadly illness, you know, I think it comes better from you in some ways. You know, I myself as a practitioner, you know, I can certainly say that when I see people that have, you know, obvious mm-hmm. unresolved mm-hmm. issues, that's going to be a stumbling block. But, you know, many times people have a real block on this because, you know, the process of forgiveness can be very painful mm-hmm. for people, mm-hmm. and they'd really rather just be stuck in their bitterness and anger and feel very justified in doing so. So I think that kind of information coming from somebody like yourself is especially valuable.
Thank you. Then, Dr. Isaacs, so you believe that a patient's attitude is important.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I would say there, too, is that, you know, I think it's important for the patient to believe in what they're doing. In other words, if they're very, very frightened by not doing what their oncologist says and, you know, doing something else, then it may not be in their best interest to go against what their oncologist says if that's how they're feeling. You know, I think that a certain amount of faith and trust is very, very valuable. And some patients can do that with something that's kind of off the beaten track, like what I do, and some patients have a real problem with it. So I think that people need to think that through and decide if they really feel like they can make that kind of a jump.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Isaacs, do you think that surgery has a place in the treatment of cancer?
I do. I do think that surgery has a place in the treatment of cancer. With the early stage disease, it can be curative. You know, the data pretty clearly states that. And I also think that even with a treatment like what I do, that having a decreased load of cells for the body to try to deal with can be beneficial. For instance, colon cancer, you know, sometimes people will tell me that in the course of the application process that we have people do, you know, they'll say that they don't want to get the surgery, but if the colon lesion is causing bleeding or a blockage, then getting the thing out really makes a lot of sense as far as I'm concerned.
Right, I agree. And many knew of and respected Dr. Gonzalez's work with cancer. Can you tell us what it was like working with him?
Well, he and I worked together in one capacity or another for, you know, more than 25, 30 years, something like that. So, you know, it was a very intense time. We went through a series of steps, you know, trying to get more scientific study of the work that we do. He was a highly motivated physician and very passionate. He had been a journalist before he went to medical school, so he was highly articulate and a great writer, a great speaker, and very, very dedicated to his patients. So it's a real loss that that he passed away. He was 67. I can't remember how old he was. Mm-hmm. He was 67 at the time that he passed away, and it was very sudden. We at first assumed he had a heart attack, but at this point, really, not really sure what happened exactly. I know he was always under quite a bit of stress, but it was a devastating loss for me, for his patients. But I'm persevering, continuing to treat people, and I know that's exactly what he would want.
Mm-hmm. And you both are noted for pancreatic cancer, isn't that correct?
Well, that was what we chose as a research tool, so to speak, just because the outcomes with pancreatic cancer are pretty uniformly bad.
Right.
And so it makes it easier to study. There are some other illnesses, like prostate cancer, for example. You know, some prostate cancers are extremely aggressive, and some the patient's probably going to die of something else before the prostate cancer makes any impact at all. And so prostate cancer would be harder to study for that reason, because you have quite a mixture of different levels of illness. So pancreatic cancer was what we used back in the days when we were trying to do research. But we have case reports of a wide variety of different types of cancers for stories of patients that have done very well.
Mm-hmm. Pancreatic cancer, I've interviewed a couple survivors, and they seem to have almost a full-time job maintaining their health afterwards. And my hero is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had pancreatic cancer. And yet this woman continues on and is so feisty that I think she's marvelous.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I believe, though, she's done pretty much standard treatment, right?
Did she?
I don't really know. Yeah, I don't really know much about what her treatment choices were, but I had the impression that she'd gotten surgery and chemo, but like I said, I really haven't investigated. And with pancreatic cancer, if it's found early, surgery will give roughly, about 25% of people that get pancreatic cancer surgery will still be alive and cancer-free 5 years later. So there are a few people that will do well with that procedure. It's a big operation, though, and that's one of the ones where I am not really necessarily pressuring people into doing that if they think it through and decide it's not for them.
Dr. Isaac, do you make changes at all in your protocol over time, or do you find that what you have used has continued to be the most effective approach to treatment?
Well, the basic structure of what I do is really similar to what Dr. Kelly used, you know, our predecessor in this work. The basic structure is the same, but I'm certainly going to add things that I find helpful, like things like resveratrol, for example, which I think can be pretty helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly the same. Nothing's going to be static. Completely. But the general structure is the same, and part of the reason for that really is that, you know, Dr. Kelly had phenomenal results. You know, the cases that Dr. Gonzalez found in Kelly's files, you know, are unbelievable. And I mean, obviously I believe them because I've seen the medical records, but they're incredible. And so, you know, why would I change it just based on, you know, some article that, you know, maybe some half-baked scientific finding? You know, and there's a continual drizzle of information in the medical literature, and some of it's valid and some of it isn't. So I'm not going to turn everything upside down just based on stuff that was done in cell cultures or in mice. You know, that's my general approach.
Well, I think that's the right approach. The reason I ask is I had never thought about changes in protocols. And so when people ask what I used, I tell them what the protocol was. But when I interviewed Dr. Vickers about the Gerson, he mentioned that he had made some changes recently based on research that was out there. And one of the things was using the beamer, which is a electromagnetic energy beamer, I guess. Then I realized, I guess that makes sense, that if there's a lot of research, you would change your protocol. And I know Dr. Forsyth has made a lot of changes over time in his approach. So that was the reason I asked the question.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, as an example along that line, I'm becoming a fan of infrared saunas. I think that's a way to stimulate sweating, and that's another way of detoxifying. And I think that had they been affordable and available when Dr. Kelly was practicing, I think he would have used them too. You know, so certainly Kelly's program modified over the time that he was in practice. And so, yeah, sure, absolutely. Things will change, but I think that probably the fads that I will be more resistant to, like, for instance, the current one is the ketogenic diet, which focuses on trying to eliminate, the food sources that cancer can have. And people wind up on these very draconian diets. But the thing is that there really isn't any good data in people yet, I'm concerned.
No.
And until it shows up, I'm not going to tell people not to drink carrot juice. I've got patients that are alive. You know, that one of Dr. Kelly's patients from Dr. Gonzalez's original study of Kelly's work was a woman who was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer at age in her late 30s, probably, and she was diagnosed in 1975 and went on Kelly's program, and you know, she was doing great at the time that Dr. Gonzalez interviewed her in 1986. But I actually tracked her down I spoke to her last year, and she's still doing great. And she's 85 years old at this point, so she's a 40-year survivor of metastatic breast cancer, and she was drinking carrot juice the whole time. So I really can't argue that. You have to eliminate all carbohydrates from your diet to have an effect on cancer, because if that's the case, she would have died a long time ago.
I agree with you completely. I had fruit. I think maybe the only thing that was limited might have been bananas, but I don't remember that for sure either. And I think sometimes when people try these drastic changes, that it might work on one thing, but cause problems in another part of the body later on. And so I wonder about the ketogenic diet, what effect that is having, say, on the liver or on the kidneys. I agree with you that your approach is the right approach. Is there anything else then you would like to say before we look at your books, your products, services, and how listeners can reach you, find you?
No, I think we've really covered the ground pretty well. I've certainly enjoyed talking with you about what I do. In terms of how people can track me down, my website is drlindai.com. My last name is Isaacs, but I realized there's an amazing number of different ways that people misspell it, so I just went with my last initial. So that's drlindai.com. And what they'll find on my website, there's a description of what's involved with the treatment, and there's also an application process that we want people to do. I don't want people to come all the way to New York and then have me tell them that I don't think this is a good way for them to address their problem. So I ask that people send in some information ahead of time, which I'll review just to see if I think this is a reasonable fit for them. So all of that process, I don't charge for that. I only charge people if they actually come into the office for an appointment. Mm-hmm. And all of the costs and the costs for the supplements and everything is all broken down on my website. So I think most of your listeners will find that's pretty complete. Mm-hmm. We've tried to make it so anyway. And again, that's drlindai.com.
Mm-hmm.
And something they'll find on the site if they poke around a little bit is a link to various articles that I was thinking in particular of one that Dr. Gonzalez and I did that's a series of case reports. So it's talking about various people that have done well on our protocol with a variety of different types of cancer. So I guess one of the ones that always stands out to me is the patient with pancreatic cancer. She, in November of 2000, she went to her doctor because her stomach didn't feel quite right and she had lost some weight without meaning to do so. So in credit to her doctor, the doctor immediately sent her for a CAT scan and they found a tumor in her pancreas. Then she wound up getting a biopsy in February of 2001 and it definitely confirmed that she had pancreatic cancer. So she was told that surgery might cure her, but she decided to refuse it. It's a very big surgery. Many people get quite sick just from the surgery itself, and its track record isn't all that great. It's one in four, perhaps, will be found to have been cured by the procedure. The other three will have had it, and then they have a recurrence anyway. So she decided to pursue this approach, and she is still alive and doing just fine. And we're now talking, we're coming up on 18 years since she had that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a diagnosis that 18 months would have been astonishing. 18 weeks is probably more typical, but she is now alive 18 years out and living her life and doing what she wants to do. So that's an example of the type of case reports that that we have available in that article.
And you co-authored a book?
Well, Dr. Gonzalez and I wrote a book called The Trophoblast and the Origins of Cancer, and that's referring back to Dr. Beard's thesis about the trophoblast, the early stages of the placenta, and how he believed that pancreatic enzymes could have an effect on the trophoblast cells and therefore potentially on cancer cells. Now, Beard had theorized that that the trophoblast and cancer were similar just based on their appearance under the microscope. But since then, there's been a lot of research done in the orthodox medical world that says that the trophoblast and cancer cells use a lot of the same mechanisms to do what they do in terms of invading and creating new blood supply. And interestingly enough, even since that book came out, The Trophoblast and the Origins of Cancer, which came out in, I believe it was 2009 that he and I published that, but even since then, there's been even more research suggesting that that pancreatic enzymes, the proteolytic enzymes, may very well affect both trophoblast cells and cancer cells because both of those types of cells have receptors for those types of enzymes on their surface. So my own personal prediction is that the orthodox medical world is going to come up with the exact same theory that Dr. Beard did sometime in the next 10 or 15 years. You know, unfortunately, pancreatic enzymes are not something that a pharmaceutical company is going to make a lot of money off of because they've been available as for therapy for digestive issues for 100 years. Mm-hmm. And so there's no money in it for the pharmaceutical companies, but nonetheless, the research is going forward. And so it wouldn't surprise me if 10 years from now, you suddenly read in the in your local newspaper, pancreatic enzymes can work against cancer. So we'll see. It may get there.
Right, right. It's all about money, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, yeah, it can be. That's how the world can work. And I guess, somebody's got to pay the people that do the research. I understand that. But unfortunately, that can mean that there's a kind of a built-in bias or tunnel vision about something like this kind of work that that involves products that, can be pretty cheap, basically. I mean, the types of treatments that are available these days for cancer, sometimes it can cost like $100,000, $200,000 a year for somebody to be treated. And, I could treat a lot of patients for that much money.
Right, right, right. Well, I appreciate this so much, Dr. Isaacs. It's been very interesting, and I've listened to it in relation to what I actually did, and it has several components that are very similar, and then, it has some that are different. I know that it's a very successful approach, and I just was so happy to have the opportunity to interview you. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. I've always wondered if the major medical centers would go investigate the people like you that have that are still alive and kicking with these diagnoses that should have taken them out a long time ago. If they would go track those people down and ask them what they did, I think they might learn something. So, in fact, I once had a physician that came to me as a patient who had done that exact same thing. He had gone into the tumor registry at his hospital looking for patients that had had his diagnosis and that had survived a long time. And he probably violating all kinds of privacy regulations while he was at it, but he called up a patient with his diagnosis that had way outlived what should have happened, and it turned out to be a patient of Dr. Gonzalez. So I really do think that would be a valuable thing for them to do. Heaven only knows if they ever will, but
right. Well, the word is getting out. A lot of people are moving away from the traditional and toward the alternative for many, many reasons. And I think that it takes a long time. As I say, it takes a long time for research to get up with practice, and it takes a long time for traditional medicine to accept some of the alternative things. I think one thing that still isn't accepted, and that is the whole idea of the anaerobic and the aerobic in the cancer cells versus the normal cells, and what it does in terms of sugar intake for energy. And they accept this on the CAT scan, but they don't accept the theory. But really, CAT scan, isn't it using the theory that there will be spots if they give glucose that it will show up more where the cancer cells are because they take more glucose in order to convert to energy?
Yeah, the PET scans use radioactively labeled glucose, so any active metabolic cell will pick up a lot of glucose in that PET scan. Sometimes there can be a little confusion because inflammatory cells can do that too. But they definitely use that whole idea that the cancer cells are rapidly growing and so therefore more likely to pick up the glucose in the scan.
Well, thank you again. I appreciate it very, very much.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show. I hope some of the information was useful to you, and I look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host, wishing you a great week.